I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, an opportunity to reveal the hidden landscape, make the invisible visible, and turn the unsaid into the unignorable. We may be in the digital age, but there are people in here. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you're on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, author, technology thinker, and I'd like to think human romantic, Joanne McNeil.
It feels so pathetic, but at the same time, that's why we live. We live for our humanity, for it to continue, for it to be in exchange with other humans.
Joanne is going to share some of the inspiration for her new novel, Wrong Way, and share the profound beauty of human connection. It's time to intervene on our own behalf. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. I'm really glad to have the opportunity to introduce you to a longtime friend of mine, Joanne McNeil, who I met, 15, 20 years ago, maybe. I don't even know if she's that old. But a long time ago, back in the early 2000s and the brighter, weirder internet days, she's written a novel. I guess it's her second novel called Wrong Way, which really kind of blew my mind. It's this wonderful story about a woman who gets a job driving an autonomous vehicle, right? And the whole idea is that these autonomous vehicles are fake and they have drivers actually hiding inside them the whole time. And it was this great metaphor for so much about the digital age. And so I'm really excited to have her. She was the winner of a great arts writing award, the Carl and Marilyn Toma Art Foundation Writing Award. She's been at iBeam. She's been at the Logan Nonfiction Program. She's an instructor at the School for Poetic Computation. She has another book called Lurking. But this new one, Wrong Way, is the one that I just read and then had to speak with her because it's very Team Human-esque, as you'll see. So here's me and Joanne McNeil. Hey, Joanne.
Hey, it's so great to see you.
It's great to see you.
It's been a really long time.
It has. I was trying to think when the first time I met you in real life, and I think it might have been at a Rhizome 7 and 7, did they call it?
Maybe it was that I was thinking of the Contact Con that you organized. I probably met you before then, but that's at least when I got to know
Contact
you.
Contact Con.
That was such a cool conference.
2011, a one time only. Yeah, it was going to be annual. That was great. It's like $99 unless you didn't have the money, then it's free. And you just came to this giant thing, right? And everybody just showed each other stuff. It was like,
it was so cool.
Occupy Wall Street tech support is kind
of. That's it. I mean, I would love for some kind of events to happen again where it's like the good people interested in technology to kind of find their way.
Oh my God, the good people. That's very direct. When I was doing it at that conference, I said, it's going to be our opportunity because 2011, you know, the net had already sold out terribly, you know, and it was going to be an opportunity to fold the weird fringes back to the center, you know?
Yeah.
But now it's just like we can be straight up just to bring it. Good people back. More good, less evil. Oh my gosh. There's so many things. We're on such parallel, in such parallel headspaces, even though we haven't seen each other in so many years. It's like you've tracked my whole fucking psyche in this. I mean, just so parallel. Your images in your fiction are the quintessence of the ideas that I've had, but never really had like metaphors for. And I was realizing, oh, that's kind of what fiction does, is you create, you know what I mean? It's like, duh, it took me until I'm 62, whatever it is, that it really does. It's like, oh my God, that's it. That's it. That thing is it. So thank you for those, because it just really helps. It helps. It's like, it's validating. I feel seen.
That means a lot. Because I mean, your writing, of course, is something that I've learned from. I mean, you've kind of been there at the moment when we need it, with Program or Be Programmed, with Team Human, with Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. I mean, your books kind of emerge at the moment when we need them.
Oh, so good. Yeah, we've both been along for this ride. Gosh, so let's just start with the thing then. Let's just, who cares? I mean, you know what I mean? If I'm a professional interviewer kind of person, I'm supposed to go through biography kind of stuff, but whatever. So there's this image, and it's not giving so much away, because you get this 20% into the book, the new novel that I keep forgetting the name. Wrong Way. Yeah. Wrong Way, which is exactly. I mean, that about says it right there, right? Wrong way. It's not even a three body problem. It's just wrong fucking way. But the central image and kind of ongoing never-ending joke of this book is that there's a driverless cab company that hides human drivers in the supposedly autonomous vehicles. They're crouched in there. I mean, you use an image earlier on, kind of like that your protagonist kept hermit crabs and would go to the store and buy other shells for their, and that's basically what it is. These little humans inside these things. And the image of human flesh, little human flesh being inside these machines is just so striking. It's so Team Human that the worst part, the scariest part of the Team Human enterprise is that we're just being absorbed or surrounded, or we're becoming the last little, like some drop of flesh in some giant Elon Musk brain machine thing. You know, this little dab of human.
Yeah, because when you put it that way, it feels so pathetic. But it's at the same time, that's why we live. We live for our humanity, for it to continue, mm-hmm. for it to be in exchange with other humans.
Yeah. But this, I mean, this character and you and me by extension in some ways, you know, so she starts, there's these great scenes where she's basically like a sales clerk at the equivalent of Sears, you know, which is great. I mean, that's so from the last media environment too, a catalog store, right? I mean, most kids, people listening probably don't even know what we're talking about. You know, it's not quite Wells Fargo wagon catalog, but it was like that. Sears, you'd get this big catalog and you'd pick stuff for like Christmas or something, and someone would order it and you'd go to this department store and pick it up. It was weird. I guess you could shop in there too, but almost nobody did. It was a strange place. But she's working in there, and the way you describe it, working in this giant machine. I mean, because Sears was a machine. We were already in machines in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what I was thinking through different kind of work environments from the past to now, that probably how an ordinary woman's life, you can kind of tell the history of technology through someone who isn't trying to be extraordinary and is quite ordinary and proud to be ordinary.
Right. I mean, in some ways, she's the opposite of a tech bro, not just gender-wise, but also in terms of her ambitions for life. And
Yeah. It was something that I knew I had to get the character right for the book to work, because it is so character-driven, but it also had to be a character who is not savvy in the ways of a typical tech critic. In fact, is sometimes skeptical in the way that a lot of people, just in general, though, the public has skepticism about Google. I mean, I didn't mean her to be unsophisticated either. In fact, like she is interested in art, she's interested in culture, but has no ambition to be famous or super successful. That's just not what drives her at all.
Right. Well, and also she's facing, as many of us are now, many of us, certainly Team Human listeners, facing so much immediate precarity that there's really no time to worry about greatness. You're worried about the utility bill.
Yeah. And a lot of that is the stuff that's coming from my own life. Is like when I was writing it, I was really fearing my own future. I was feeling like there are ambitions that I have, there are things I want to do, but I have to get these needs met first. And I don't really see that in a lot of contemporary fiction. It's more like just the drudgery of a job isn't really expressed. It's more like they went to work and then the actual drama of their lives takes place. Or it's something vague like, oh, you know, they've got student loans, but the actual pain, the kind of fear and anxiety, I wanted to make that known. I wanted for readers who maybe aren't even familiar with it, I wanted them to get a more visceral sense of how frustrating it feels to be trapped under debt, under obligations, and without a clear path forward.
Right. I mean, but it ends up feeling so, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we both love. It feels so human and ordinary to our actual experience. Because even if I want to pretend like I'm some like special because I have a podcast and I wrote these books, yay, it's still, that's like 2% of my lived experience is being whatever Douglas Rushkoff is. And the other 98% is getting, like, deciding whether or not to throw out this sponge. It took me, I was stuck like 10 minutes today.
Yeah.
Is it really dirty enough to throw? It kind of is gross, but am I going to buy another sponge? And it's the normalcy, the bathroom, the bills, the medical insurance not reimbursing for the thing that's supposed to be a copay. It's like, that's my friggin' life, right?
Yeah.
And then to see that that's it, you know, and it's like, until you, I mean, I'm sure there's other people have done it. It's like you almost had to go to like a show like Roseanne or something to see people. And then it's like a thing. Like, oh, look, this is the normal American. You're like Roseanne or Cops, right? And you see real people.
Yeah. And I think, of course, Roseanne has not really kept up the what I would say putting a working class.
Well,
and the right, what, she got rich.
She got rich. And the particular working class that she represented become kind of the MAGA working class. And those folks, I'm sorry, they have, and I always get in trouble when I talk about it, but they have a heck of a lot more in common with the perspective that I think that we're espousing than we might want to admit. They also see a vast machine, you know, robbing them of human experience and a sense of safety and prosperity.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many ways to respond to hopelessness and despair. Many of them are not great.
Right.
From where I stand, which is more privileged than the character I wrote, but I've certainly been in extremely precarious moments of my life. My goal is to build a better world that we don't have so many people in despair with zero opportunities. I mean, it sounds fanciful and that sounds science fiction, but actually I think this is so galvanizing at the point of just being able to like have something resembling a home, healthcare, childcare, all those needs. It shouldn't sound science fictional. It's something that we all want. How do we get there? What changes need to be made at a community level, and even like as small as like what we can do, that so many people want it. That's powerful.
Right. But on the other hand, I mean, in some ways, the character in your book gets the golden ticket, an opportunity to be at the next, whatever it is, Tesla, Uber, Google, something. And it's a real job. It's like, you know, the Starbucks fantasy.
Yeah.
She crouches up into this secret compartment in a car. And you worked out all the details, which I will leave for other people. But how do they get in and out of this thing? Why doesn't anybody know they're in it? How do they keep the secret? I mean, my God, fleets of these things with human flesh in them hidden. I mean, but that's, you know, on the one hand, it is, she can get out of precarity by having this job. It's not by digital standards. This is not such a bad job if you can, you know, deal with the confined space.
Oh, yeah. Those were some of the contradictions I was playing with. I wanted it to be like I heard from Instacart workers when Instacart was new, they gave all these great opportunities and it seemed like an amazing way to make some money. And like, that's a lot of those gig work jobs. When they launched, it seems like, oh, I can make some money. I've got some security finally.
I know. I remember those the ones at Lyft at the beginning, because it wasn't Uber, and they all had the pink like bunny ears or whatever, the pink lips on their car. And they were all so, yay, we're doing it. I'm part of the digital revolution.
Yeah. And then slowly over time and surely that flexibility, there are all these kind of strings attached, and the money they're making for various reasons is not what it used to be. And so I think there's like, when we see her, the job is good with a number of strings attached. But I also wanted to play with like the idea that like, this would be an embarrassing job to let someone know you have. If she met someone who isn't doing this job, like how would she even say what she does for a living? I mean, I really brainstormed a lot of jobs that I had out of college, things like being in a call center, and how when I would meet people who went to better universities than me, I'd have to kind of not lie, but present what I was doing for a living as something other than it was, and because I was embarrassed. And so you can make the money, you can also have like a lot of shame about it. Like,
I went to one of those schools and then was doubly embarrassed, right? I remember I was doing, I thought it was a great gig. I was getting like $30 an hour to mix sound for an off whatever show in LA, right? It was a musical, and I'm just mixing sound around, making $30. And I'm sitting in the back during the intermission wearing a Princeton t-shirt, and the producer of the show comes by and he's like, oh, where'd you get that shirt? And I said, well, you know, I went to Princeton. He goes, well, yeah, right. If you went there, you wouldn't be doing a job like this. And I was like, and I was thinking, this is better than the SAT tutoring I'd been doing like right up till then. It was it's a gig. Oh my God, it's so sad. You know, that pride and shame and all that even gets mixed in it. But that's why is it wrong to talk about how much money you make, right? Who invented that rule? And I always thought it was bosses invent that rule so that you can't compare and contrast, right? Oh, you're making 12. I'm making 15. You know, hey, Joe's making 15. Give me 15. So we're shameful about that, rather than, you know, as Astra Taylor would tell us, you know, we should have solidarity about our situation.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Well, I think that's also because I have a lot of friendships that are cross-class. Mm-hmm. And I always notice that there are wealthy people that don't want to be friends with me because it makes them feel awkward. And it's like, no, I don't expect you to like buy me lunch. Like, actually, I would. I'd like it if you did. But like, we can just have lunch and split the right. check. Like, that's okay. But like, it's so clear, like when I've met people who come from wildly different right. class backgrounds, how they are way more uncomfortable with me than I am with them. And that's another kind of class element that I really want to attention that I wanted to put in this book.
Yeah. Well, you got that. Yeah, there's that kind of Miley Cyrus character in there who I was thinking, like a Hannah Montana sort of woman who moves into that company. But yeah, there is this other, I mean, that's the thing. If you are supposedly non-existent driver of a car, right? Think about how far can we externalize labor? Like, this is what in my books I was calling the dumbwaiter effect. You know, the Thomas Jefferson invented the dumbwaiter not to save labor for the slaves, but to hide the slaves from his guests. So here's the ultimate sort of enslaved individual whose very existence is not acknowledged by mostly wealthy people in the vehicles, because they don't want to think that there's a human taking them around. It's sort of like, oh,
yeah,
just a chip.
I mean, it explains so much about like Silicon Valley mindset right now. And I don't need to tell you this, but like even things like New Zealand bolt holes, like, great. They would love to just imagine the entire world is gone and it's just the billionaires left. It's just kind of like they don't want to have to see us or acknowledge we exist if we're not in that upper echelon. And hiding the more precarious than you, the wealthier you get, the more people you want to hide.
Right. Well, you don't need socialism if you only have a couple of thousand rich people on the planet serviced by robots, right?
Yeah.
But I get this feeling that you are, like me, concerned for the soft, squishy human in this emerging landscape of terrifying yeah. machines.
And I think like one thing I love about this show and what I like about these kind of conversations in general is that we need new ways to express what we're fighting for. I mean, it's just like humanity means so many different things to other people and to someone like, I mean, just like Elon Musk, I mean, what he thinks humanity is basically just what could be replaced by robots. And like, what is it that we are trying to preserve? What is it that the arts mean? I'm watching this, like, so much of culture that matters to me, that is why I am who I am and what drives me. Things like art, passion for art, seeing that just kind of like the value of it being degraded by this conversation of AI art. And I'm trying now, especially in my nonfiction writing, how to be more precise about the inefficiencies of life that make life worthwhile, the passions and care and connections that we make with one another. That's ultimately why this book is so character-driven, too, is I needed the reader to cling to this character. I needed them to take some time in her mind. She is ordinary and also eccentric in the sense that like everybody has their traumas, everyone has their passions, and to sit for a moment with an individual who is so unlike this technological context that we're living in right now, that was really crucial to me. And that's when I realized this novel was working. Like when that contrast came to me, when I had the sense of the character, I knew I could get I knew it was ready to go.
But she's also, for me, she's also you. You know, she is. Because, I mean, I don't know how much you want to get into it, but I've, you know, followed your journey over the last 10, 20 years, whatever this was, with fighting the fight on behalf of people and artists and sensitive souls against even well-meaning institutions and well-meaning foundations and organizations that nonetheless have succumbed to the industrial logic, right? And you, as well as anyone, maybe better than anyone, have been able time and time again to articulate why this is not just some okay boomer nostalgia for something, right? The problem with New York City getting replaced by Starbucks and TD Bank, right, is not that Starbucks coffee isn't as good as Chock Full of Nuts. It's that the priorities of the market leave out the soft, squishy, inefficient nooks and crannies in which humans like us actually thrive. Mm. It's like, I don't know where to live except in those folds.
Yeah. And I think for years, like, people have been really blasé about conversations about gentrification or, you know, those moments when capital is testing our boundaries as people and organizations. And standing up and being dramatic if you need to be, like calling attention to it, acknowledging that people aren't necessarily going to get it. That when I first started complaining about things like Midjourney, a lot of people were like not understanding where I was coming from because they didn't understand what training data is. They didn't understand what this technology was ultimately meant to do, which is just like crush, you know, squeeze labor, squeeze the arts, which are already on a shoestring budget as it is and struggling to hang on. I feel it. And it was also very important to set this book in Boston for that reason, but not just because I grew up there, but I feel like this is a city that you see how culture has been gutted from the city on a street level, like walking through neighborhoods. If someone has been there 30 years ago, it's stunning what isn't there. And the youth are still there because there are schools. But the places to have that culture are not. And a lot of people are like, is this a nostalgic book? And I didn't want to think about it in those terms necessarily, only that it feels, if I were to say, you know, maybe in 20 years we could have 50 bookstores in Harvard Square, that might sound fantastical, science fiction thinking. But in fact, this is something that we had years ago. Like, I mean, it maybe not 50, but maybe there were 30 bookstores. I mean, something like half the bookstores in the country have disappeared in 20 years. And that's a place where we had these exchanges, where we had culture and community, and we could meet each other in these spaces. And yes, there's exchange of money taking place, and that's like, that is capitalism. Yeah, but there's something
going on. It's
not business,
it's commerce. There's a kind of a difference. Yeah. You know, you're allowed to exchange value without investing from afar and extracting value from people who are actually working. There's kind of, I would say, or even limited capitalism is okay. Dad, can I have $200 to start my lemonade business or whatever? You know, I get that fine too. But the thing that's saves you in this book, and I think, and it helps us, those of us who are trying to make these arguments, what saves you in this book from the accusation of, oh, it was better when, was the fact that she did grow up, her first job at a friggin' Sears equivalent, was to say this enchidification or indebtification of the working life was already in place. You know, this has been since the industrial age. Talk to some coal miner. I mean, what's the coal miners who were going down into those tar pit things that they worked in is even worse, you know, in many ways than the person who has to sit in the cramped roof of an autonomous vehicle.
Yeah.
You know, we've been doing this to ourselves for centuries. It's just there does seem to be something different about when we do it programmatically, though, you know?
It's not the turbocharged level, the speed in which it happens, the speed and confusion, in the sense that technology, as Silicon Valley applies it, is meant to obscure something.
Right.
It's always just kind of presenting itself as something that it's not really doing. The marketing, the branding, the aura that it creates, and your lack of control as a user, as a human, as a person who is snagged inside these systems.
Yeah. But who published this last book? Someone good, right? I mean,
Both my books, they were with MCD, and I'm really happy to be published there.
MCD is?
Imprint at FSG.
Right. And for people who aren't publishing people, what's FSG?
It's...
I don't know how to say the last word. Farrar, Strauss.
Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. I might be saying it wrong,
Giroux.
Too.
So, right. So it's like they're classy. Because the weird thing is, you know, because usually these people are so bad, right? But they said on your book cover, there's one sentence where they said, and I was like, oh, fuck, this is like somebody who read you, which is so rare in publishing. McNeil turns the unsaid into the unignorable and captures the existential perils imposed by a nonstop full-service gig economy. But turn the unsaid into the unignorable, and you've said in some interview somewhere that you're trying to make things visible. You're trying to make the invisible visible. And then you tell the story about the hidden worker inside a car, and it makes us look at the world and then see the embedded labor, the embedded humanity in all of this stuff. I mean, you could do it on Midjourney. I would hope Midjourney becomes the tool that teaches us, oh, look, there's all that embedded human work in there.
Yeah. I mean, one scene I really felt strongly about including in this book was as Teresa's kind of getting deeper into this job, she starts wondering about her world, and she just thinks about things like, well, I just took an elevator. Could that have been a human being lifting it up and I didn't see it? It's just like all of a sudden the entire world has changed to her. She doesn't know what to believe or what is human labor and what is technology. And that's kind of where I'm at, too. I most of us have had experiences calling up for tech support or something and getting an automated system, and you're not even sure if it's automated or not. And I've talked about my own experiences. I worked in a call center, like I said, and I read scripts the whole way. I really cannot offer any of myself to this job. I was basically acting as a machine. And that job, as much as I hated it, as much as I wanted to get out of it, and it paid me nothing, it changed me in ways that a lot of jobs did not. It changed how I thought about work, how entrapped you can be, that I had this job that barely paid anything. I had a commute that was almost an hour and a half, so 3 hours sometimes of my day. And I couldn't move out of my parents' house because I just wasn't making that much money. And just like, that could have been my life if a few lucky breaks didn't happen. So these are things I think about a lot and I put into this book.
Yeah. Although it's funny, you know, sometimes I forgot what it was. It might have been this company. It might have been like Land's End or something. I was like buying like a birthday present for my wife, like a sweater. And I called up as a pretty confused consumer. And I got this elderly woman, operator person, who sat with me 40 minutes to help me pick which sweater, which knit, what size. Oh, those buttons are really sweet on that one. Yes, I do agree. Is she petite? Oh, well, that might be good. But take a look on page 47 and you'll see. And I was just like, oh my God, this is like my grandma was back. Actually, so there are opportunities for the human just to show up, although they're so surprising. I remembered it, right? 20 years ago, I'm remembering a conversation because it was so unique. But then you think, oh, we could just be living our lives like that, like talking to people and engaging.
I mean, it could just be our days if people had like that space to not be living in your own frustration and grief or panic or anxiety because we need to make a living. I mean, I just think about your pleasant conversation. I was just thinking about, I took a flight the other day and I I open up the window as we were landing, and the woman next to me thanked me for opening up the window. She's like, "It's so beautiful. Thank you." And I'm like, I know it's beautiful. And it's just like those kind of exchanges just make your day. It's like that little kindness that you can express with another person and like little blips of little moments. Yeah. Just that's what we need more of.
It's just so hard because and this is part of the, you know, we're all gig workers on some level, but it's like I was experiencing this too with the podcast and trying to write Substacks. The pace of the internet is not my pace. It's like having a boss telling me to be more faster. You know, you didn't put enough things in that box, you know, in enough time, or you're going to get fired because little Joey down the line can get, you know, 30 items in a box in 27 seconds. You can only get 17.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, fuck. So I got to go, you know, and then you're trying to, again, it's about this time is money ethos of efficiency that we still haven't dropped. It was like one thing in the industrial age, but efficiency, when it's that monitored surveillance efficiency of the digital age, really turns us into something less than human. It's hard.
Yeah. And you know what I always struggle with, and I actually love your perspective on this too, because like with my writing, that's where I need to separate myself from that mindset. I need to be free and creative and preserve myself from putting a price on what I'm doing. I don't want that to creep into the way that I write. But at the same time, I don't want to shortchange myself when I'm in the marketplace because, like, yes, you want to be paid for your work. But at the same time, the actual practice of writing, how do I keep that in my own sphere? It's something that I wonder about because I never want to have to write a novel for money. I just couldn't do that. I have to write it for me. But I also can't just like neglect the the state of publishing and value external to me.
No, and they're making it harder and harder every year. It's like there used to be in publishing, it was kind of like one big slush fund. I mean, it was. They would kind of rob Peter to pay Paul and the editor, you know, I'd write this book and it's not selling much. And the editor said, don't worry. Angela Lansbury's autobiography came out this month. Everybody's happy.
Yeah.
You're going to slip in under the radar. It's fine. He says, and then when it all got corporatized, when every publisher got bought by Bertelsplex or whatever, the you know, the one, it's like one big machine. They're looking at your numbers. I talked to my literary agent. She's like, well, yeah, maybe you shouldn't come out with something just as a proposal right now, you know, because we don't want to hurt your numbers and my numbers. Oh, so it's like, well, unless you've really got, you know, a piece of art that you really have to get out, then of course we'll figure it out. But I understand what she's saying, that there's this whole computers they're managing. They're managing what the computer says about you, you know, and book scan and
it's
what it
is. There's all that data and decisions made by that data.
I know.
I am not
my data. I provide this value that you can't really see in the data. they don't get that. I'm a prestige writer. I help the other books on the shelf. Oh, like the friggin' cobbler on 12th Street that's gone. Well, it doesn't make as much money as a Jamba Juice. I know it doesn't make as much money as a Jamba Juice, but I liked having a shoemaker in my neighborhood and he liked being there.
And just seeing that level of expertise and kind of the beauty and having that knowledge about something esoteric and possibly that it's passed on through the years through apprenticeship and all of that.
That goes away. That goes away. It's but then there's this other quality to the digital media environment. Like there's the one that we're talking about now, which is its kind of amplification and exacerbation of capitalism and hiding labor and all that. But then there's this other one that came to mind because you're writing fiction and writing in images. And I may have been, and if I did, it wasn't in a bad way. I may have been a little bit stoned when I was reading the book, so which is fine. Some parts of it, fiction
probably
works
helps.
Stone. Yeah, in some ways. And I stopped. I kind of flashed on this image of the digital age. You know how digital is discrete, right? everything's quantized. And then I started to think of digital as all these quantized pieces out there. And then how do we take continuous human beings and put little pieces of human flesh on each one of those little bits that are out there? So it's like, as we move from the sort of analog world to the digital one, we fracture ourselves into all these teeny little pieces, and you kind of jump from piece to piece. But that feels like there's the reversal has happened now, where we, even in the industrial age, it was sort of discrete human beings using lots of machines. And now I feel like it's one big machine kind of using little individual human flesh pieces.
Or maybe not even individuals, that they're just like treating it all like slop, as kind of like raw material. So it's like your humanity is in this soup that is just useful for words and to be broken up. Yeah. That's what the AI kind of training data aspect of this moment we're in with technology. But I think about like those pieces when you were talking about like the human in this digital space, I think about those moments that over the past 20 years the internet has provided, where I would be searching Google for maybe a pair of shoes that I want to see some review of a pair of shoes, and I'd stumble upon maybe like a forum that hasn't been updated since 2008, and there are people discussing this brand of shoes, and then the conversation turns to maybe, you know, I'm getting a divorce and I'm, can you help me? And then you're like reading the whole thing and you're like, oh my gosh, this all happened in 2008 and this is years ago. Who knows where these people are now? But like, you read it and you're like, somebody wrote this. That's like, that's you seeing this like alienated, having this alienated experience with another person's humanity. That's really beautiful about the internet, especially social elements that internet. Right.
Or at least that was. It's funny because it was that. And then, you know, I was complaining about Facebook, you know, profiling us and you, taking our data and all. But at least when Facebook was taking our data, it was in order to understand us as individuals and appeal to or manipulate me, Douglas. Now with the AI, it's just, oh no, we just want that piece of your cheek that we're going to put over into this. And then that's something you... two sentences you wrote over there. So they're not, they don't even want me as a coherent, integrated human. They just want, they want our data piecemeal, generic, like you're saying, like that pink, what do they call it? Pink slime, like the food that they give kids in school in the bologna, that pink slime meat. It's not even, there's no cow.
Or I would say something like Facebook is training its users to act like predictable, like machines are, that it gives you only so many ways to behave and express yourself. So you are kind of like slowly but surely being trained to be quite automatic and predictable. And that frustrates me too, because I do see some of that, you know, in the Elon fanboy nexus of the internet. Like, there is something almost bot-like, even if this is a human being typing out, there is just something like automatic and constrained in where, how they're behaving.
Right. And the weird thing is, you know, and the dopamine makes it, I understand, it makes you feel like you're alive, right? Yeah. Because it's like, rah, rah, you know, that dopamine plus a little testosterone, you know, but it's not living in the way that we're saying. It doesn't have grain. It doesn't have the full human essence to it. But there's a, it's just like, you know, when you put adrenaline, you know, you take an adrenaline dropper and put it on ants, you know, these chemicals will make them animated, but it's not, there's no texture to the experience anymore, and certainly no connection in it.
Yeah, this is maybe a little bit off topic, but lately I've been thinking about how much I enjoy disagreeing with someone on terms that are still acceptable, because it's like I've gone through so many stages of like, this person is an anti-masker. Okay, I can't be friends with them anymore. That's really weird. Or like, you know, it's just like there have been so many, or someone just like you thought was a reasonable person and they're like, oh, I'm going to vote for Kanye. And you're like, what? It's just like I've had so many interactions with people because I have like a lot of different types of people in my life. And then when you meet someone who just is like, you completely disagree with, but it's within the realm of like acceptable, it's just like, oh, this is what it's like to just kind of like not be on the same page with someone. That's kind of nice. I mean, you're still my friend. I just don't agree with you.
And right. Yeah. And to just be there. Right. It has to be a certain kind of a disagreement. So it's like, you know, if you go into like a really dangerous place, like Israel and Palestine or whatever.
Yeah.
Like I can hang out with somebody who's, you know, I think Israel was just a bad idea. I think, you know, the Britain, they should have, they broke the place up and they said, you go here, you go here. The Jews were desperate. They took the deal. And look, that, I get it. You know, I can see that. But it's a way more acceptable position than I think all of this kind of person should die or,
you know. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's like looking for those spaces where it's like, oh, we actually, we part ways here, but in a friendly, it's just the way it is. Like, cause it's, I've been missing that sense of like, of just friendly debate. Like I've just been like craving friendly debate.
People can't do it anymore. It's like, and that's partly the digital thing too. It's like, everybody's kind of, it's like we're walking on ice. I don't mean that it's thin, but that it's slippery. So you start going in one direction and then it's like, zhing, you're all the way crazy there. So if I say in one conversation, well, you know, I think about this, Trump was actually kind of right. Then all of a sudden, zoom, now you're a MAGA crazy, you know, it's like, no, come back.
Yeah.
And there's no, it's hard, but humans in real life, you can do it. It's a way easier. Like you go to a pub in England, I mean, sometimes they'll have fights, but usually people like Labour and Tory and whatever, they're there and they're going to be back the next night. So they can't disagree to the point where they can't come to the pub anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like the terms of being part of a family, too. That's some, like, you can't necessarily stay in touch with someone who has extreme views that isn't necessarily part of the family. But inside a family, you probably have learned techniques how to, I mean, of course, there are extremes that you don't, those techniques stop working. But like inside a family, you learn how to negotiate with family members, you learn it. And so sometimes you have those debates inside a family, but like when it comes to neighbors, friends, just the opportunity to be more conciliatory in myself. I like being able to have that ability.
Yeah. And there's so much that I really want to say sometimes, what's it to you? You know, really?
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, it's tricky. I do at least partly blame not digital technology, but this kind of more, in a more McLuhan way, this digital media environment for this way of thinking, this incapacity. You're on yes team or no team, one team or zero team. And there's no, you know.
Yeah.
It's hard. But that's what the artists are for.
Yeah. I mean, people, but bad faith readings of viral threads and, you know, the kind of that we are on these big platforms of social media, but people interact on these platforms as communities and take things out of context and blow things up or don't. And that we're reading them so in brief and not giving our best reads necessarily to material that's on the internet.
Well, that's because the best read won't get you the most hits later.
Yeah, yeah.
You gotta pull it out of context. It's like, that's what we're talking about, like the human flesh out of context, your ideas out of context. And part of taking them out of context is not just to maximize profit, but is in order to weaponize them. And it's just so unfair. It was how MSNBC became really hard or impossible for me to watch, because they would take something, and I don't like Trump. I'm not saying I like Trump, but they would take something that Trump said and say, oh, look what he did. And then you look at the actual what he said and you're like, he really didn't. I'm sorry, but you're lying here. That's not what he meant. Even big news stories, you know, this whole thing about Biden, that the if you read the special counsel report on Biden's thing with the whatever they were all mad at him about. And they said, you know, the news says that, oh, the special counsel says that Biden is an old man who can't remember anything. That's not what they said. Mm-hmm. They said that this is going to be really hard to prosecute because Biden's refusal to testify about certain things that happened in the past will likely be interpreted by a jury as he's just an old guy. He can't really remember it. That's very different than saying he's an old man. He's saying he's going to be perceived as an old man and get off, so we might not do. And it's like, and nobody's telling the truth. And it's like, what's going on? And they're having arguments back and forth in media about something that's like fabricated. And it's so off. It's so off. It's so hard to navigate.
Yeah, it's really out of control. I was thinking of what's that Don Henley song about the evening news and how sensationalistic it is, and how, like, listening to that now, it's like, really, that's your problem with the media?
We're way
past, like, just murder as, like, headline news. It's just
I mean, I look back at Neil Postman or somebody talking about, you know, amusing ourselves to death and all, and he did see. He knew we were going in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
Or Daniel Borstein talking about the pseudo event. And now we've got a pseudo president as an event, right? A pseudo event presidency. So they got it, but it still looks quaint, you know, like Mad Men looks so quaint as those evil mad advertising Madison Avenue guys compared to what's happening now.
The time to think, that's what I am. I feel like nostalgic, not necessarily for my time, but I feel envious of that time that you would have half hour to go through the community, the newspaper, and process it, as opposed to need that quick jolt of something, which is how that kind of news is functioning.
I mean, do you have some hope that it's turning? I mean, I feel like the fact I mean, every few weeks I kind of go, I'm going to stop this podcast, whatever. But I feel like the importance of doing this is that people are doing this, that we are standing up for the squishy human part of things.
I feel, maybe I'll regret saying so, but I feel incredibly hopeful, because like the hope that I have is that, you know, looking at publishing, everyone is mad at how publishing is running. No one who is mad hates books. They all are mad because they love books. Mm. So when you have that passion and it's being thwarted by industry, something's got to change. And maybe it won't be as perfect. You know, maybe people will forever be nostalgic for those 80s publishing stories of whatever, you know, the 20s authors, how much attention they got. Well, I mean, we can have better than we have now. We can always do better. And I think with culture, I got my start writing on the internet, on blogs. That's how I became a writer, is because editors in New York found my writing. They reached out to me. This is not something I ever thought would have been possible. And people sometimes ask me, do you think kids now could be discovered like you were? And I've really gone back and forth where, like, blogging was ideal for that, but there are still newsletters, there are still opportunities.
There's Substack, there's Medium, there's places.
Yeah. And I myself have found young writers through things like their newsletters, through various online spaces. And It might mean playing with different forms, but I think that the love is still there. We still want books. We still want beautifully written writing. In fact, one project I'd recommend you check him out. His name is Bill Shaner. He has a newsletter called Worcester Sucks, But I Love It, and he's based in Worcester. And he's like the last alt weekly reporter. He's 32, and his writing style, it's just like, you read it and you're like, it feels like he's submitting this to David Carr at City Paper. It's like, this is wild. Like, he knows what he is doing. He knows the tradition he's writing in. And has found a way to make it possible in Worcester, Massachusetts. And I just see, like, something like that fills me with so much hope that, like, we can always wish for better climate. But if you are willing to kind of, like, try, you know, experiment, try a few things and make mistakes along the way, I don't think it's hopeless by any means, because there's still an audience for it. There's still people that really want to read good writers.
Yeah, I mean, if I wasn't worried about the whole world ending and a fiery climate apocalypse, I could be hopeful that we're going to see another cycle in publishing. That what seems to happen in publishing over the course of civilization is kind of centralization to some sort of Tower of Babel, in this case, the Bertelsplex corporate thing, and then it shatters, right? And everybody goes off to Substack and Medium and websites and this and Amazon Kindle, direct to publish, all that, right? And then we're all lonely out there publishing all by ourselves, our independent things, and we got a United Artists comes together like a film company, and here's another little cluster, and I could actually edit five people at once. Okay, you could be our editor, and now you've got an imprint, and then the imprints find each other and make a publisher. You know, so I could see that if we have time, I could see
that
happening. But I'm concerned about the other one too. That with digital technology, particularly with AI and automation, we're just going to automate the process of our own continuing disenfranchisement to the point where there's no one home. There's no customer service left. There's no lawyer. There's no government. I'm a little worried about our ability to navigate through this next patch.
I just know what I'm drawn to. And that's a work that feels like there's something vulnerable there, that feels like someone is really putting their heart into it. And sometimes I might be mistaken. Sometimes that might even be AI, but that's like the work that draws, that gets my attention. And I think we have to kind of believe in it, that maybe it will be those blockbuster films are all made with AI and it's just going to gut the labor force. And maybe there will even be best-selling novels like the Harry Potters of tomorrow will all be AI generated. Maybe that's true.
Right. Well, yeah. If they take over Stephen King or something. If they want to take over the commercial thing, then we don't ever have to worry about selling out ever again, because the AIs will sell out for us.
Humans, you do that.
The art then, right? It's like if your human being's going to make a guitar, it's going to be a handcrafted friggin' guitar, right? And if the machines are going to make them over in, you know, Vietnam or wherever they're printing them out, then fine, let them make those ones. But I'm more worried, like, but will they be air to breathe and plants to eat while we do this?
Art? Because the planet is being destroyed in the process, and it's like
Where do you sit on that? And do you worry about those things? Or you seem so more worried about the role of the artist in the society that you're kind of maybe not thinking, worrying so much about burning up.
That's hard. I guess it's kind of like that's at the scale of the need for policy change. And I can only, when it comes to the future, I do think about at the community scale. And like if there are disasters, which of course there are going to be, if there is calamity in my community, all I can kind of hope for, my hope comes from having people there, knowing what I can contribute. I'm not in policy, and I kind of don't really have the answers there.
Yeah, no, I don't mind that. I don't mind that. I mean, I say that a lot. It's like when people ask, oh, so what about the Middle East? What about Afghanistan? What about that? And I'm like, look, I'm sure there's a couple of 100,000 people who really know about that thing and they can work on that. And I'm going to like do all this. I'm just going to try to make the world as resilient as possible, help people collaborate with each other. So whatever needs to be done, we're going to be able to do it. But, you know, it's like, no, not every one of us. And this is another digital thing. There's this feeling like every one of us has to be aware of everything all at once.
Every
shark attack, every nuclear accident, every...
And at all times, as opposed to like, I mean, throughout history, you would just read the newspaper or see the film reels and have your life. And that's something I've been thinking about, too, in terms of like, it's not selfish to live your life at the same time as various disasters are happening. It's just your life, and having that strength to give back is also crucial. But at the same time, we certainly do know people who are kind of like being selfish. it's not just living their life. It's like living lives at the exploitation of others. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I wonder why I'm not more cynical. And maybe someday I probably will wish I had been. But right now I feel like when in the people I know and the friends I have, there is so much goodness and care, and maybe we can't make a difference with it yet, but if that care is galvanizing, it's gotta count for
something.
It's making
a difference in real time. It's making a difference in the texture of the actual lived relationships you're having. I mean, and on a certain level, what else is there, right?
Yeah.
But it's like, I mean, it's funny. I sometimes when I've thought of you over the years, and I don't mean this in the way it's going to sound. I mean, I've sometimes felt like you're kind of too good for this earth. You know? Do you know what I mean? Though it's just like you're not mean. You have no mean.
Oh, I can be mean. I can be.
Can you?
Yeah.
Oh, good. I think about like career history and who appreciates you and who doesn't, and it's just like, damn, there's so certain people, at least for me, are like little like litmus tests or barometers of environments. And it's like, I feel like you're the kind of person I could plop in somewhere, and by how they respond to you, I can now judge these people, right? Like, do they open and become human and caring and understand, or do they, oh no, do they reject the Joanne? Because, oh no, do you reject Joanne? If they reject Joanne, what they're doing is rejecting that. They're rejecting the squish. They're rejecting the visibility of the fibers of human connection that actually bond us.
Well, that's really kind of you to say. I mean, I try to just be honest in my dealings. And I mean, I'm certainly ambitious, and that's pretty much something that I grapple with all the time. Mm. It's like how to be ambitious in community rather than like hoard resources. And I also kind of challenge to myself, like I think a lot about like what is a goal that I have versus what a goal an institution might have for me. And when those aren't in parallel, you know, what can I do here? And I think that's what has kept me going as a writer, where being a writer in 2024 is not easy. It's not a practical goal. It's the world would very much like every writer to not be a writer. Right. You're just like listening to it. And those inefficiencies of having this be very much my life's work. I've had to make a lot of changes in my day-to-day to make it possible. And I feel very lucky at this stage of my career that it's not something that I have to fight for like I did. Like when I was in a call center, I'd have to fight for those 20 minutes that I'd work on my blog. Like I had to fight for those 20 minutes. Now I could kind of get that time. And it's not nothing.
But we're still, oddly enough, we are still, I mean, supporting our writing with a lot of other career activity, let's just call it nicely. And that is odd because honestly, and this is the thing, if I am going to be reminiscent or nostalgic, 40, 50 years ago, I promise you, writers, even at our level, would be just writers and have like houses. Right?
Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah. It blows my mind when I read something like Joanna Russ's The Female Man sold 500,000 copies. And that's like The Female Man. And like Samuel Delaney's Dahlgren sold like almost 2 million copies. And you're like, oh my goodness. Those numbers, like these, they were not the romantic authors of their day. They were authors making this wild, experimental, political work, and
they had more readers than the average HBO Max show has viewers.
Yeah. But what that says to me is that this is avant-garde can be mass culture. It was. Mm-hmm. It can be again. And I do not believe that like my writing is a too prestigious for like an ordinary, you know.
I could read it, it's and like, I'm a bad reader.
It's just, but the avant-garde can be accessible. And I feel like that's like the power of art, that there is like, there is an audience. It's just thwarted right now. It's not, the things that are published at scale are not necessarily, I shouldn't really go down that route, but like, it's just like.
Right. But it's why on a certain level, yeah, I am okay with the AIs writing that. If it takes, you know, it's because then like, it will also clear the works. I mean, the works are gummed up with bad writers who just want to copy Marvel or something, right?
Yeah.
And there's so many of them because they think they can make money. So if they were all in the same boat as us, so the only ones who make big money is like Sam Altman because his AI is going to write the next blockbuster. And then there's all these other writers who are in it the same way we are. Maybe you'll get by, but it's a lot of work and you have to really care about it the way writing used to be. The only people who wrote books in the old days were people who are willing to type a book. You know, it's this friggin' computer that made it, that lowered the barrier to entry, right? Yeah.
And also knowing what it takes to write a book, I am so much more appreciative of a book I love now that I know what it takes of a person to put themselves that way and to put that time in. The time and labor, how you appreciate that as a fellow artist, I think that that changes. And it's something that is part of like my appreciation when I see a novel that really hits it out of the park. I mean, I'm stunned that this is possible, and it feels, that's when I feel filled with hope.
Yeah. I mean, and sometimes they are so good that they're so good. It doesn't seem humanly possible to have done that. You know, I was just rereading, what's it, Confederacy of Dunces?
Oh, yeah.
By O'Toole. And it's like, this is beyond human ability, you know? And it's, you know, sometimes Jonathan Lethem goes there sometime. He wrote this book, and people don't like it. I love it, called Chronic City. He wrote this big book about pot smokers, I mean, but like in a really deep way, and there's someone on the moon, and there's a virtual vase, and it's just like, man, the amount of different things that held together in one person's head for that length of time. It's like, fuck, man.
Just channeling it into one work. It is like every book like that, it feels like a miracle. And
Well, and just so you know, for me, even though it's shorter, much shorter, your book's a miracle for me too. Really, it really is. I mean, you know, I hate talking to people about books on Team Human, especially because if the people haven't listened or read the book themselves, and it's like, what are you doing? It's like, what is this? Like recap of a Succession episode on a podcast? You know, you'd listen to them, but. You know, the central metaphor of the book is inspiring enough that I think people can relate to what you're doing, you know, by making the human visible again and coming up with an image like this person trapped in a autonomous vehicle as the hidden human. It kind of says it all, which is the beauty of a book like that has such a powerful kind of Mechanical Turk, you know, metaphor in there. But you're doing it, and that's inspiring to me. That's why I read it and just go sentence to sentence and thing to thing and image to image. It's like, oh, they're on the beach, and I can feel the texture of those little pebbles under the feet, and it's like, then it's like, oh, right, this is what writing was for. This is why I loved Samuel Beckett, and when the guy passes out because he doesn't know, getting all crazy now. There's a scene, and I think it's Murphy or Malloy, where he doesn't know which side, he breaks his cookie into two pieces or something. He doesn't know which one's bigger, and he's so hungry, and he passes out of hunger while he's trying to decide which piece to eat. And when I was reading that, I was like, Beckett is alive. He's here with me now. He knows I'm reading this. I am one with, and I felt so connected. You know what I mean? That literature do that, and you did that. I was just like back with you, and I was like, oh, I get it. I was like, I felt like I was in your essence. Do you know what I mean? And that's so comforting to be in someone else's essence, because you're like, oh, because that makes me more human too. So thanks for that.
I love that, because you know, one of the things I was a little bit shy about, worried about, is like, it is middle-aged woman's experience that's very personal to her, a lot about who she is, her values. And, you know, I certainly put a lot of my own experiences into it, or friends' experiences. And I just kept thinking to myself, you know, when I read a J.T. Bauer novel, I am not the same age as J.T. Bauer. He is a very different person than me. Octavia Butler is very different from me. And like the beauty of fiction is that you can sit with another person's experience. And I just like to know that people can sit with me, and that it's not too small. It's worthy of fiction. That means a lot.
Mm. It is. That's the whole point. Small is the new big. But no, it's not that. Small is the new small. And that's where it is. It's where it is. Each second of your life is when it's actually passing. It's not these pinnacle symbolic moment that, boy, people are so externalized at this point to revalue and to treasure our actual felt lived experience. Changes the whole thing, changes the way time passes, you know, it changes again. It's like, oh God, we're alive. We're here. We're together. This is good. This is good. I know it's a lot of shit, but this is good.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. Thank you.
That means so much. Thank you, Douglas.
Thank you. Everybody, read Wrong Way, just and buy it. You know, usually I say steal it or whatever, but buy it because we have to support this kind of work. Read Wrong Way. Or there's another book lurking.
Yeah.
You could read that too. Read that.
They're
next.
Both on paperback too. So
yeah. Or get it from your library. Yeah. That's the best. If you don't have the money and if your library doesn't have it, then you tell the librarian, oh, yo, get this for our library, please. And they'll write it down and they'll buy it. And then the book still gets bought and you don't have to pay for it. It's this great, you've got one in your town. I'm almost sure of it.
And then it stays there too, which is so nice because, I mean, that's the thing you always worry about with these books, that like, they're just going to pulp them all in a year because it's more cost efficient and the tax forms or whatever. And it's just like, but in a library, you know, it's at least there are library collections.
Because as a writer, I mean, as a regular writer, not a whatever best-selling writer, I tell you, books are like magazines now. They'll be, if you're lucky enough to get Barnes & Noble to buy, you know, 12 copies to distribute to the 12 stores that they've data mined to see maybe would sell one of your books, they're going to be there for like 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then and then they return it. So go for it. Go for it. Well, thank you, Joanne. Thanks for what you're doing.
It's always a joy to talk with you.
And thank you for being on Team Human. You can find out more about Joanne McNeil in our show notes, or just go get her novel Wrong Way right now. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run FutureTools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.